Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
It's surprisingly easy to get a loan to go to college. So easy, in fact, that student borrowers currently owe more than $1 trillion in the U.S. But the majority of those loans are managed by just a handful of companies with loan servicing contracts, companies that have few incentives to really serve student borrowers and, in fact, stand to make more money from those who fall behind on payments. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. With estimates that more than 40 million Americans are in debt for education, problems with loan servicing companies are a big deal and could push this enormous industry dangerously close to being too big to fail. Two guests are here to talk about their investigation into this for Fusion TV. Daniel Rivero is a producer and reporter. Laura Juncadella is a reporter and researcher. Their documentary about student debt in America, The Naked Truth Debt Trap, aired recently on Fusion. You can find a link to their reporting at think.kera.org. And they join us this hour from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Laura and Danny, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
How does the current amount of student debt compare with what we've collectively owed in the past? Like, is it more compared to GDP than it used to be?
So since the financial crisis of 2008, we've seen a sharp uptick in the amount of money that students are taking out. And we've seen that growing faster than the general population growth. You know, more people are getting educated, so you would see in mostly any economy, more people getting educated, taking out money, but we've seen it grow much more rapidly than it has in the past.
And to put that in numbers, the number of collective debt or student debt that is owed is growing about $100 billion a year.
Wow.
Or sorry, $1 billion a year.
Okay, $1 billion a year is the amount that it's growing. Defaults are rising on these loans as well. What makes it hard for borrowers to pay back what they owe?
Well, I mean, there's many factors on that. And one of the key ones is the jobs market. You know, what are the jobs that people are graduating school? What jobs are they going to? How well are those jobs paying for? What are people being trained to do? The quality of the education that they're getting. There's a lot of schools that do a really good job, and then there's a lot of schools that people graduate from them and they have a really tough time finding lucrative work. So they find themselves in positions where it's nearly impossible to pay off the money that they've taken out. That's a big part of the problem.
I was surprised to learn that people with relatively small loan amounts tend to be the most likely to run into trouble with repayment. What did you learn about the reasons for that?
There's a whole slew of reasons for that, but one of the biggest reasons is generally students that are lower income have less of a safety net. So when they take out loans and then they run into trouble, they have a harder time paying them back. If they have to drop out of school or if they have to take a semester off, they end up with debt and no degree. Usually when you take out more debt, you end up with degrees that get you jobs that are more lucrative and you can pay back your debt more easily.
How does repayment work with a federal student loan? When do you start paying that money back, and what are the terms typically?
Usually you begin repayment about 6 months after graduation. The terms vary whether it's a private loan or a federal loan, but you have a 6 months grace period in which you're expected to find a job and be able to manage your finances to start repaying your debt.
How did it happened that Sallie Mae spun off its own loan servicing function and allowed these private companies to come along and take care of that?
Right. So Sallie Mae was at one point a quasi-public company through much of its history. And basically it had the federal – it's very complicated. I mean, you get into some very complicated financial transactional things, but to strip it down to basics, basically, Sallie Mae was the middleman in a lot of loans that were taken out. The federal government had a program where they would back loans that banks would. They would back loans that banks would profit from. So Laura, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah,
it's very complicated.
The whole system is incredibly complicated, we found in our reporting. So essentially, they would guarantee loans that students were taking out, and if the students failed to pay them back, the federal government could step in and pay them back. So it became a very lucrative business.
It became lucrative for banks that were holding the loans, but the banks didn't necessarily have money down on it. They just stood to gain from it as the loan was paid off.
My understanding is that Congress cut out the middleman of private banks that were collecting federal loan repayments as part of this deal. Does that savings, any of that savings, get passed along to the people who are borrowing the money, or is it Sallie Mae and the federal loan servicing companies that are actually gaining from this?
So a big game changer happened when Obamacare passed. And in Obamacare, there was a provision that dealt with student loans. And basically, the federal government stopped going through middlemen to issue federal student loans, and they started giving direct loans to students. So that changed fundamentally what these companies that were operating in this space were doing. What service were they offering? So what you have now is you have the federal government directly giving student loans to students, and you have the federal government contracting with these companies in order to get that money back. So in what the companies are doing, the role that they played has shifted significantly since 2010.
By the way, I further complicated things a minute ago by saying Fannie Mae. We're still talking about Sallie Mae here, so forgive my error there. How do interest rates on student loans compare with the rates that most of us might pay to buy a house or a car or some other item?
Well, student loan interest rates vary a lot, and they're, for a lot of them, are pretty high. I would say, you know, they're pretty steep. And, you know, one of the solutions that has been proposed, Elizabeth Warren is someone we spoke to a lot for this project, and she proposed actually lowering interest rates or taking out interest rates as a way to take the profits out of student loans.
And currently the rate that that federally backed student loans are seeing is 6%. And, you know, we all see commercials on TV. You take out a car loan, you know, 0% interest, 1%. So it's in some ways it's significantly higher than other sectors of the economy that people need to take out loans for.
And I would add to that that's just federal loans. Private loans can be all over the place.
They can be much higher.
Is this a significant revenue source for the federal government? Like, are they making good money off students who have to borrow to get an education?
So this is actually a point of contention. Because this program is very new, this program of the federal government issuing so many direct loans, there's a lot of things that we don't know about how it's actually going to play out. We're still in the early stages of this. Some of these loans might take 20, 30 years to come to the end. So there's a lot of different projections that people use, and there's different accounting techniques that are used to calculate, is the government making money on this? Is the government losing money on this? And it's become pretty partisanized. I mean, the Democrats tend to take the view that the federal government's making money on this, and more conservative lawmakers take the view that the federal government's losing a lot of money on this. And it really just comes down to which of these accounting calculations do you use in order to take all these things into account. But it's all perspective at this time. We really don't know what the answer is or what it will be.
So just a small handful of companies have moved into this space of servicing federal student loans and also some private loans. Tell us about the biggest company.
Well, the biggest company out there is Navient, which was the company that was spun off from Sallie Mae and took over all of Sallie Mae's servicing. It's a huge company with several billions in profit. Did you know exactly how much, Nanny?
Yeah. Navient services about 12 million borrowers, and they have a revenue of about $5 billion last year, and their profits were, what I have here is $681 million in profits last year. So, and they have about 7,000 employees, so it's a pretty lucrative business to be in.
So this week there have been accusations that Navient might have been involved in insider trading. Have you been following up on that news?
So that was a very recent development. This just came out yesterday, and it was actually the AFL-CIO which is the biggest union organization in the country, basically came out with an accusation saying, it looks like someone in Navient was doing insider trading. You know, we haven't had a response to this. They've asked the SEC to look into it. It's a pretty stark accusation to make. So publicly, as they did, you know, Bloomberg was reporting on it. I got press releases. It's very early on in the game, but the company has been accused of doing a whole lot of things that were questionable, and this is just the latest of them.
Navient is also being sued by the Attorney General of Pennsylvania.
Yes, and Illinois and Washington State as well, and as well as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
What are their concerns about the way Navient's doing business?
Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's lawsuit centers on poor customer service, to put it simply. So they were not putting borrowers into repayment plans that were helpful to them. Meanwhile, the Attorney General lawsuits, at least of Washington and Illinois, allege the same allegations, Pennsylvania as well, and in addition, allege that the loans that were given out by Sallie Mae, many of these loans they knew would fail or they would not, or students would not be able to repay them, but they were giving them anyway in order to open up avenues for other types of revenue to come towards them.
So I guess the big question in cases like these are, is Navient really supposed to be serving Sallie Mae and the banks and American taxpayers, or are they supposed to be serving borrowers? Can they do both simultaneously?
So in the case that they have with the federal government, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they had a filing that they put in the suit where they were trying to get the suit quashed. And there was this question about who is the company Navient responsible for? In whose interest are they looking out for? Is it the taxpayers or is it the consumer who's calling into them, who's being serviced by the company? And in the lawsuit, they said, quote, "There is no expectation that the servicer will act in the interest of the consumer," end quote. So basically, they're making the argument that their duty is to protect the taxpayers who are paying for these student loans and not necessarily to help the students who are being serviced by this company. And the two really seem to be at odds. You know, if you're a consumer here or if you're a taxpayer paying into it, it's not your goals aren't necessarily aligned. And that's a big question that's underlying all these lawsuits is what should the goals be?
If I don't love my mortgage holder, I can refinance maybe and go to a different company. Is that possible to do? If I have a student loan that is serviced by Navient, can I go across the street and deal with Great Lakes or Nelnet?
So you can refinance your student loan. You don't necessarily have a choice who your servicer is. Your servicer is assigned to you, and you're kind of stuck with them. I do know that when you refinance, sometimes you get a new servicer. I don't know that you always do.
And there's no way to know when you take out a loan who you will be dealing with.
No, there's some mystery sauce that goes on.
Yeah, there's an algorithm in there that the federal government uses to kind of give you this guy or that guy, but mm-hmm. you don't have any say in the matter.
Loan servicers have been accused of overcharging borrowers. How would that happen?
So one of the allegations in the lawsuit is that the Attorney General's and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's lawsuit is that Navient was steering borrowers into these poor repayment plans. So what would essentially happen is they would end up in forbearance, which allows them to not pay for a certain amount of time, but they continue to gain interest when they could have applied for programs that accrued no interest.
All right, we'll talk more about that in just a minute with my two guests from Fusion TV, Laura Juncadella and Daniel Rivero. Their documentary, The Naked Truth Debt Trap, aired recently. It's about student debt in America. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with two journalists from Fusion TV who recently produced a documentary called The Naked Truth, Debt Trap. It's about student debt in America. My guests are Laura Juncadella and Daniel Rivero. If you would like to find a link to their work, you can go to think.kera.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Okay, we were talking before the break about loan forbearance, which, if I understand this correctly, amounts to a few months where you are not making payments, but you are accruing interest the entire time?
Correct. So this is an option which we actually spoke to a former employee of Navient, and she told us, and this is also corroborates the allegations made in the lawsuits against Navient right now, that if a caller calls into Navient to try to lower their payment or make a payment, you would assume that they would try and help these borrowers find the best payment. A lot of times what happens is that putting borrowers into forbearance is the most expedient solution. And what happens while they're in forbearance is for X amount of time, they don't have to make any loan payments. Meanwhile, interest keeps accruing. And once their forbearance is up, they're expected to pay this amount, and it's a much larger amount than they went into it for. A lot of these students actually qualify for what's called income-based repayment or income-based deferment, so not even having to pay anything on your loan if your income is low enough. Income-based repayment gradates how much you have to pay based on your income, as the title suggests, and you actually can keep paying your loan if you're doing income-based repayment and your total is going down. Income-based deferment, you're not accruing interest and you're not paying either. But registering borrowers into these programs takes a lot longer. And call center expectations don't match with that.
I know this is all very wonky.
Yeah.
But I'll try to break it down a little bit if I can, or just add to what Laura said. So basically, if you're a student and you're struggling to make your payments and you call into Navient and you're saying, hey, what kind of plan can I get into to help me get my payments together? One of the things that Navient is supposed to be doing contractually with the Department of Education contract is help people get into these income-based repayment plans, which would mean you're paying lower monthly. The life of the loan might live on longer, but you're going to be able to make your monthly payment. Now, what Navient has been accused of doing and what the whistleblower, former employee that we talked to told us is that employees of Navient are being told just to put people into forbearance because it takes such a long time for them to actually get you into one of these plans that the human resources cost of doing it is so expensive it would cut into their profits. The most expedient thing for the company to do would just be to put you in forbearance and just kick the can down the road a little. And technically, they're still servicing your loan, but they're not necessarily having to spend phone time doing it. So it would be more profitable for the company if they just did that.
I mean, how much can a half hour of call center employee time possibly cost? I'm guessing they cannot possibly make more than $15 or $20 an hour. It seems like a negligible amount of money.
I mean, you're saying half an hour. The call length expectations are 7.5 minutes, and that would be 7.5 minutes to identify your income, go through your tax return, and, you know, do a whole lot of math before getting you into a program.
And then also, if you're in one of those income-based repayment plans, it requires more follow-up, so you'd be doing more calls, perhaps once a month. It might seem pretty petty, but you're talking about they're servicing 12 million borrowers' loans at this point. So it can multiply several times over.
It adds up.
Okay, yeah. Before we go to the phones, I want to talk about this. Navient has been, and its competitors, have been packaging and selling debt to investors, which sounds suspiciously like the kind of schemes that put the mortgage industry into so much chaos 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. One of the biggest revenue generators for a company like Navient is what they call SLABs. It's student loan asset-backed securities. You know, for normal people speak, that means they're just taking a bunch of these loans and they're packaging them together and then selling them to people in the expectation that the students who took out the loans are going to pay them, and in the long run, you're going to make a lot of money on it. Now, that's been called into question because more and more people are defaulting on all these debts. And the big question is, you know, it might not happen this year, it might not happen next year, but at some point, are all these defaults going to add up? And are you just asking people to put money into a bubble? And is that going to pop? And this is, student loan debt has become the largest consumer debt in the country over the last 8 or so years. So right now, people owe more on student loan debt than even mortgages in this country. So it's, I mean, this is a huge part of the economy. And it's basically prospective. And, you know, the government's spending less on education than it was in the past. So people are taking out more loans. So it's only growing at this point.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak first with Raina in Van Horn. Hi, Raina.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Driving
can
over
you
some,
hear me?
Are you driving over cattle guards? Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, I pulled over.
Okay.
Yes. What I wanted to say is, you know, I graduated in 99 with about $25,000 worth of debt. And I went into the forbearance because it took a little while to find a job that, A, I could actually make a living at. And so I've been paying in for 10 years at a little bit over 7% interest, which is fixed because I'm not allowed to change that because it consolidated a few years ago here in Texas. And I still owe at this point the same amount that I graduated in debt with. I've paid well over $39,000 in interest back. And so what I was telling the girl who answered the call was there should be a provision once you, you know, and I realize it's a business deal, but I mean, I've paid credit card, car loans, mortgage, and I've been able to make, you know, make traction in my debt. But there should be a provision since this is some sort of federal interest kind of program, apparently. So once you meet and pay, you know, in interest what you borrowed in debt, then some, you should be eligible for forgiveness. I mean, I work at in a nonprofit type setting, but I'm not eligible for the nonprofit according to the program.
Well, Raina, thank you so much for your call. Let's see what our guests have to say about that. Is anybody talking about this kind of forgiveness after you've paid not only the principal, but a whole lot in interest over the course of years and years?
So on, you know, on an official level scale, I haven't seen or heard too much about that. But on the topic, I will say there are many lawsuits brought by individuals that are out there with basically the same circumstances that the caller mentioned. Basically, when you pay into a student loans servicer, you might give them, say, $200 one month. Now, you would hope as a consumer that the bulk of that money is going towards the principal. What a lot of these companies have been accused of, and there's been a lot of settlements out there, is that they're actually taking the money that they're getting and they're kind of dropping it into different buckets and they're applying it to the interest but not to the principal. So the total amount that you're paying for is not necessarily going down. You're paying for overhead, basically. You're not paying towards the bottom line that you took out in the first place, which can be very frustrating. And it's why you have some people just opting not to pay at all because the number is not going down. They're just paying for the interest.
How does this affect the ability of people who come out of school with or without a degree to start paying for things other than their student loans, to hit those what we used to consider adult milestones like buying a house?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the experts I spoke to talked about the student loans crisis as this more of a slow drag on the economy in the long term. It's taking, you know, young people longer to buy houses. You have less expendable income to start your own business. So it's definitely pushing back the timeline if you're stuck with student loans for years after graduation. And the caller mentioned that she graduated in 99 with, you know, an amount of debt that is very, like, much less than what students today are graduating with.
And I would add that there's an added dynamic to it, which is related, is that it's affecting people's life decisions, like to get married, not to get married. Because if you get married, all of a sudden your debt's all going to be bundled together. But if you're not married, you know, one of you can have this crippling student loan debt and the other one can't, or the other one doesn't. So it might make sense to you financially just not to get married. And, you know, that might have other effects on the social kind of aspects of this country.
Yeah, because this is also going to follow you on your credit rating, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Melissa calling now from Houston. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I'm a student at the University of Houston, and I'm actually scheduled to graduate in December. And I was wondering if they have any advice for students that are either about to graduate or just graduated on repaying, you know, this daunting amount of debt that all of a sudden they have to pay back.
So I would say I'm not a financial advisor, but and I'm not a counselor, but the best thing that anyone can do is just learn as much about the terms of what you have entered into. And if you already have entered into a contract, just try to understand the parameters of the system and what you're looking at and what you're expected to do. Know your rights. There's a lot of people out there that have resources. We have on our website at fusion.net a list of resources that can help you understand what your rights are, what you can expect, who to talk to if you're not getting what you're supposed to be getting. That's all I can really say about that.
There's not a whole lot of information on the websites. Like, I can speak from experience as a parent of a student who has just started with student loans, and you don't find a great breakdown sometimes of what you're paying when you go to one of these loan servicer sites.
Definitely. I would say it's you go to these websites and they have very little information, and the little information they do have is really hard to understand, even for us after a year of working on this story.
Yeah.
That makes me feel better, actually.
Yeah. Trust us. it's been really difficult. But, you know, it's reading, it's doing your research. There's a lot of other, you know, people who are advocating for students that would be helpful, and we do have that resource list on our website. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been very active in the student loans arena, so I definitely would use them as a recourse for any borrower.
And I would just add to this that, you know, we did a story, and a large focus of it was on Navient, who's like the biggest student loan servicer, and we found that they have the most complaints per capita of borrowers that they service. I will add to that Navient says that most of the complaints they get is about systemic things, not necessarily having to do with their exact loans, but about the complexity of the system and how the whole thing works. So the complexity of it, I mean, I talked to I don't know how many experts for this story, and I'll tell you, nobody knows this system from top to bottom. Even if your entire career is studying student loans, how it affects different parts of the economy, your focus is probably narrow. Like, there is nobody out there that understands this thing in a 360-degree kind of viewpoint.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Fusion TV producers of the documentary The Naked Truth, Debt Trap, Daniel Rivero and Laura Juncadella. If you would like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. All right, let's go to the phones now and speak with Terry in Austin. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Yeah. I am. I just give you a quick background just because it'll help with my question. I borrowed money years and years ago, 30-something years ago. And at that time, you locked in a rate. That was what's so great. You had very few servicers. You locked in a rate. They couldn't raise your interest once you signed that promissory note for that loan. Paid it back. Flash forward several years into the 90s where I was going back to school to finish my bachelor's and work on my master's. And you could borrow this exorbitant amount of money. And long story short here, I had, when I graduated after that, I had about $100,000 in debt. So I had some forbearance, as you do, as you're trying to get enough money together when you go back to work and you're working full-time and that. But through the course of this time, I have been paying on this loan for several years. I owe more now than some people on a mortgage. The interest rate has been over $50,000. And I am paying in a graduated system, but if I didn't, my payments would be over $1,400 a month. The interest is, I'm 60. the interest is never going to stop. There is no way short of disability that you can get out from underneath this. Not that people don't want to pay the debt, but like the woman that was on earlier, how many years do we keep paying? This is great. The cost of college has gone up exponentially the more people can borrow.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Terry. I'm sorry to hear about your ordeal. I'm guessing, Danny and Laura, you met a lot of people who are in a similar situation.
Oh, definitely. I spent most of my time during the story talking to borrowers who were in very, very similar situations where their interest rates or where their interest had ballooned and they just felt they were never going to pay off their loan. I mean, part of the issue is, you know, states have disinvested from universities. So tuitions have gone up to make that difference. And the higher tuition is, the more people will borrow to go to school. At the end of the day, getting a college degree is still the best way to towards social mobility.
But some people, go ahead, Danny.
I'm sorry. I think I would add to that, I mean, as to what Terry was talking about, I mean, there's legislative answers to kind of get at that a little bit, trying to bring interest rates down. I know Senator Elizabeth Warren has been talking about it. But as far as like the foundational central issue with what we're talking about here, there's really a gap between how we talk about education and how we fund education. Funding for education has gone down very dramatically. I mean, we did a lot of our story takes place in Arizona, and there are community colleges in Arizona that get zero state funding. So it might not be totally accurate to call these public entities, even though we talk about them as public entities. And this is happening all around the country. You know, it might not be zero, but you might have a state college that gets 2% from the state. So who's making up for the difference? It's students. It's no longer put into a pool where everyone pays into it. It's you as an individual having to pay for it.
My guests are Fusion TV journalists Daniel Rivero and Laura Juncadella. Their new documentary is called The Naked Truth, Debt Trap. It's about student debt in America. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about student debt in America and how loan processors deal with those repayments. My guests are producers of the Fusion TV documentary, The Naked Truth, Debt Trap. They are Laura Juncadella and Daniel Rivero. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So everybody knows that not everyone leaves college with a degree. There are lots of reasons for this, but of course they still have to pay off any loans that they have taken out. The thing is, loan servicers are sure to have really good information about which schools generate the highest rates and the lowest rates of graduates who leaves these different schools with how much debt and what their financial outcomes are over time. How much of this information are loan servicers like Navient willing to share?
So through our reporting, we found, I mean, a lot of this goes back to what happened in 2008, which there was a provision in what's called the Reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which is super complicated. But in it, Congress basically made it illegal for the Department of Education to make school data public. So what that means is, even though the Department of Education tracks people for a certain amount of time after school, and they can say, you know, people that went to this school, they got good jobs, or they're being able to pay off their loans, that data exists, but it was made illegal to share that with people, which can have a big impact on consumers and prospective students when they're choosing what education they would want to go get. Because in the end, the education is only a means to an end, and the end is getting a good job. So there was a lot of private colleges and universities who lobbied for this to to shield that data from being public. Navient's predecessor, Sallie Mae, was one of the people that lobbied for it. And they said that it was for privacy concerns. There's a push right now in Congress to make schools share that data again, because it can help students when they're choosing their education. It's not really going anywhere, but it's being talked about. So that's something. But yeah.
Meanwhile, lobbyists for the loan servicing industry include a former congressman who believed that Pell Grants, which don't have to be paid off, are a form of welfare, which is to say advocating really stigmatizing aid recipients over people who take out loans for their education.
Yeah, I mean, in the reporting that we did, especially in the written piece that goes more into the lobbying thing, we found several former congressmen that are doing lobbying, and because they were former congressmen, you can look at kind of their public comments about, you know, what they think and how they feel about student loans as a thing, as an industry, and kind of make assumptions about what they might be lobbying for as they do it for Navient. So yeah, I mean, there is among conservatives, especially more so than more liberal people, there is kind of the talk that, you know, people who take out these loans, they need to pay them back, you know, be responsible to the taxpayers who put this money down. And if people are taking out loans and they're not graduating from school, it's kind of an abuse of the system. That is definitely, that's a viewpoint that's pretty widespread out there.
All right, let's go on the phone now to John in Grapevine. Hi, John. Hello, John. Are you with
this
us?
This is Alan in Grapevine.
Alan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I've got a question. When I was in graduate school, there were a couple of my fellow students who had just taken out a whole bunch of loans, and they got into a financial bind, and they simply went bankrupt. My understanding now is that you cannot go bankrupt on student loans. Is that correct?
Well, it's very difficult to declare bankruptcy on student loans. It's not impossible. There is something called the Brunner test, which means that you have to prove undue burden in order to declare bankruptcy on your student loan, and it's very, very, very rare that you would be able to meet this requirement.
So it's one of the only debts that can't be discharged in a bankruptcy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Correct.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Daniel in Houston. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Rice MBA student, and I'm going to be graduating with well over $100,000 in student debt. So I was interested in this conversation. But I heard something earlier about the student loan and asset-backed portion of the student loan market being compared to the mortgage market. I just kind of wanted to set the record straight kind of on, I don't think it's going to be nearly as big of an effect on the economy as what happened in 2008.
We just lost.
Subprime crisis, the most damaging part was the synthetic part of the market, where Wall Street was creating what were called synthetic CDOs. You can like watch The Big Short and they kind of explain it, where you wouldn't even be investing in actual bonds, but you'd be investing in basically a bet on the other side that somebody else was making. They would be able to package that into what looked like a bond and sell it. So I don't think there's nearly the scale. Like, it was 20-1 synthetic to actual mortgages, and I don't think there's nearly the scale of that going on right now. So I didn't want people to freak out that there's going to be like another subprime crisis.
Well, I appreciate that perspective, Daniel, and good luck when your loans come due. So it sounds like maybe there aren't as many exotic things happening with the student loan industry right now.
Yeah, I'll just say Daniel is absolutely right. I mean, actually, nobody that we talked to thought that exactly the same thing was going to happen with student loans. There is a parallel, but it goes so far. And it's like Laura mentioned, it's everyone seems to think that this is going to have an impact at some point, but it's kind of slow burning. It's not going to be an explosion one day where the markets collapse. It's more of something that will play out over a long period of time. It might be kind of hard to pinpoint exactly the moment when the bubble bursts. But if it does burst, then, I mean, it will have some kind of an impact. But yeah, to Daniel's point, yeah, it's not gonna explode the economy overnight.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Mark in Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hey, what a cool subject. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question being, has the government done any studies taking into account the current unemployed pool of grads available, how many jobs are available, and the number of grads needed to feed specific job types?
Sounds like a good idea. I'm not sure if anyone has done anything like that. Do you know, either of you?
I've not heard anyone do that specific study.
Neither have I. I mean, it sounds like a...
It sounds
like
interesting.
It sounds like a pretty straightforward potential solution.
Yeah.
The reality, of course, is that people might look at that and still choose to get a degree in philosophy. I mean, there's a lot of human choice involved in this, and it doesn't necessarily completely align with what the economy needs. I think it would be good to know what the economy needs.
Go ahead, Lara.
No, I was just going to jump off Denny's point about human choice, is that's such a big element of this, is, you know, at the end of the day, these are people making decisions about their own lives.
It's and I don't mean to disrespect the intelligence and independence of very young people, but these are huge decisions that we're asking people to sign up for when they are often not out of their teens yet. Is there something we can do to better educate the young consumers who might have these loans attached to them for decades?
I mean, I will tell you, consistently with the borrowers I spoke to, they would tell me that they were just trying to do the right thing and get a college education. The requirement right now to get a student loan is at least to take out a student loan before you begin college is an online, like, webinar type thing where you can read a few pages that gives you really complicated technical information and you click accept and then you can get your loan. So it's not enough, I don't, in my opinion, for a student to take out huge amounts of money, especially an 18-year-old who has likely no collateral, no, you know, hasn't really had to make these types of decisions. And we're giving kids a lot of money at a very young age. They definitely need more information. There's a bill in Congress right now that's been proposed, and I think it's still stuck in committee, which requires more of this type of counseling before students take out loans. But I definitely think more education as to what it means to take out a loan, what your responsibilities are, would be helpful.
And I would add to that there's a certain level of kind of a cultural conversation that should be happening at some point in the U.S. where this notion that, you know, you go to school, you move away, you get your own place. It might be time to reassess part of that, at least when it makes sense, because you have kids that are just doing what they think you should do. You should move away and join a frat and party and go crazy and take out a bunch of money. And, you know, that's all good, but you know, it might make more financial sense for you. You might be in a lot better of a place 15 years down the road if you stay at your mom and dad's house and go to community college for a couple of years before you go to another school, or just stay in state schools. That's definitely a big part of this. It's human choices. People make decisions.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, with the rising cost of tuition, you know, I spoke to one of the people we talked to in the documentary, Selena. She told me she made all the right choices. She went to community college for 2 years. She went to a local state university for 2 years, and she still now owes, you know, way more debt than she can afford in her monthly payments. She owes about $60,000. She's making minimum wage or barely above minimum wage, and her monthly payments are something that she can't afford, and also afford rent and a car payment. So, I mean, yeah, part of it is going out of state and, you know, taking out all the money you can to have the most fun you can, and the other part is tuition is, on its own, is really expensive.
This is I'm Chris Boyd. Sorry, please go ahead.
I was just going to add to that, you know, schools, as they've been defunded, a lot of them have latched onto this idea that, you know, let's recruit out-of-state students because out-of-state students spend a lot more in tuition. So there's very ramped up marketing kind of campaigns that a lot of schools and public schools too are doing to bring out-of-state students into their schools because they pay much higher tuition. So it's lucrative. I mean, it's lucrative for the school, especially if the school is losing public funding.
It really feels like this has changed also within a generation. I mean, you've talked about the special challenges of people who are the first in their families to go to school. People who are not might have parents who didn't experience anything like this when they were making decisions about where to study.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I graduated from a public school here in Miami in 2010, and it was like right when the tuitions were about to hike up. So my story is different than someone that's about to graduate right now. I mean, we're talking about a fundamental change in how people are dealing with paying with school within a 7-8 year period.
Definitely. And, you know, the whole mentality of I can work while I'm in school to pay off my loans. I mean, minimum wage or wages you make while you're at school compared to tuition, it's a huge difference. It's not the same as when school costs $300 a semester.
Do you mind if I ask if either one of you still has student loans that you're working on?
I worked my way through school. Like, I mean, in 2010, I mean, I lived at home with my parents. You know, I ate home cooked meals. Like, I did it, and then I was able to not, you know, it was affordable. I paid like $2,000 a semester. That's it.
Hmm. Yeah, I was lucky enough to avoid student loans as well.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I don't think a lot of people can say that now.
Yeah, it's very rare.
Yeah, and it seems like we won't even know the full consequences of this until this generation that faces such large amounts of money, you know, moves up into their 40s and 50s and 60s.
Correct.
That's right.
All right. My two guests are producers of a Fusion TV documentary called The Naked Truth, Debt Trap. It's about student debt in America. You can find a link to more information and their work at think.kera.org. Daniel Rivero is a producer and a reporter for Fusion TV. Laura Juncadella is a reporter and researcher at Fusion. It's been really interesting to speak with both of you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can find the podcast anywhere you find podcasts, but you can download it and also learn about upcoming programs at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.